welcome to the 15th episode of the 5th season of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's, it's Tuesday, the 11th of September, and in this episode we're going to talk about the failure of Linux on the desktop.
Yay!
And talk to Simon Tennant from Buddy Cloud.
Yay!
We will, of course, cover the latest...
Yay!
The latest news, events, bits about Ubuntu, tomorrow's technology today, and go over your feedback. If you're listening live, you can send us messages using the chat facility on the website and in the IRC channel. I'm Mark, and joining me tonight are Tony.
Hello.
Alan.
Yay.
You turned my mic down.
I turned Laura's down because she was moving her microphones down.
Okay.
And Laura.
Hello.
So, Tony, what have you been up to since the last show?
Now, you see, you came to me first.
I did come to you first.
Because you know that I have the most exciting thing.
I cannot wait for you to tell our listeners this.
And we have the longest time left on the intro to talk about it. We have five whole minutes.
Yes. We do.
Bought some new socks.
Oh, you're getting undressed. Stop that.
There you go. Look at those bad boys.
Gosh.
They're black with purple tails and heels.
They're on brand. They're on brand socks.
Good. Why have they got a J on them?
They're Jasper Conran.
Well, I think mine might have a J on.
Yeah, yours are almost identical, in fact, except a bit more washed out.
Yeah.
Mine also have a J.
You've got Jasper Conran socks, but those slippers.
I was given these slippers by my parents, who could well be listening.
Lovely slippers.
Lovely slippers.
Yes.
They're so slippery. So British.
It's the pipe and the flat cap that really set the whole outfit off.
Oh, so Alan, what have you been doing?
Do you remember the Joggler?
Yes.
Recently I dug mine out of a drawer because someone joked that everyone's Jogglers are just in a drawer somewhere.
No, mine's back in its box.
Yes,
back in its box.
In a drawer.
I returned you. You're the one I had in the...
I had three and now I've only got two, so did you?
I think I remember doing it.
Anyway, people who originally made it, OpenPeak, have put an image out so you can flash it and it removes all the original O2 branding and kind of resets it back to a kind of clean state.
Wow.
And gets rid of some of the apps that no longer work because the back-end web services are dead. So it kind of like refreshes it a bit and it puts all a few extra apps on there. So I flashed them with that, and then I discovered in the Joggler forums that someone else has made a little shell script, and you put it on a USB stick and you run it, and it adds loads more stuff. Like, it adds in stuff that actually gets taken out by the OpenPeak flash. It adds it back in again. So this guy...
Right.
Like the O2 branding.
Funnily, that bit's been left out. But, like, iPlayer stuff, and so you can watch live TV on it, and catch up and radio and all that kind of stuff. So it's... And also a funky clock, because you need a funky clock. Yeah.
It's the BBC Two logo.
Yeah,
the
from
old
1981
one.
Or something. It's really, really
like
cool.
I used to get before the school's programmes.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I flashed that, and, it's got a new lease of life.
Excellent.
And back in the drawer.
What are you going to use it for? Yeah, exactly. Laura, what have you been up to?
I took a sheep to a Dalek convention.
Sorry. Laura, what have you been up to?
A friend at work's gone into hospital, so we kidnapped his sheep. He has a small, soft, plush sheep.
Not a real sheep, okay.
Not a real sheep. Toy. It's about the size of a big hand.
A big hand, okay.
And so...
Something quite Alan Partridge about it.
So what, a big hand on a clock? Really long and thin?
So we took him for breakfast, took some photos, tweeted them, and then we set up his own Twitter account.
Right.
Sheepy the Sheep.
Sheepy the Sheep.
And, Sheepy's got around, including going to a Dalek convention
last week.
In Fareham.
Was it just Daleks?
There were people as well, but yeah.
But some of the people dressed as Daleks. Some of the people were people that go in Daleks.
Right.
Mm. So. It was very Dalek-y.
Yes.
There was a central Dalek theme.
It was very good.
The day that the new Doctor Who episode
aired.
Yes. Did you miss it as a result?
No.
We were home in time.
Yeah. It would have been.
Some people left early for it.
Wow. How about you, Mark? Anything fun and exciting? No, should we move on? Oh, well.
I got a new job. Well, I started a new job. I got it a while ago.
Hooray!
Is it for an orange and purple company?
Yeah, do you work for Canonical now?
Everybody else does.
Apparently.
Everybody.
Didn't you do already?
The rot continues. No, I don't work for Canonical.
What do you do?
I'm working for a service called OSWatch, which is the open source advisory service for UK education.
Excellent.
So that's cool.
Basically, we support, well, there's sort of a few different things we do. Basically, if someone in UK education wants to know something about open source, whether it be licensing issue, using open source stuff, something they want to release, they want to get involved in a community or something, then we can provide advice on how to go about it.
Interesting. The ICT teacher at my kid's school said to me before summer holidays, he said, I'd really like to try and use some more of that open source stuff in school. Mm-hmm. I should send him your way, shouldn't I?
Probably should.
Yes.
Particularly if he starts to work at a university or further education college.
Our remit's technically further education, higher education. I don't know what would happen if someone emailed us from a school, because I don't know if it's ever happened before, but you can give it a go.
Yeah. Let's test that theory.
Excellent. Well done on your new job.
Thank you.
Yes.
And I hope we have lots of fun, exciting stories to tell us in the future.
I'm sure I will.
Speaking of fun and exciting, we had to remind you about our competition.
Ooh.
We set one last episode. It was for the Ubuntu Made Easy book that we reviewed in that episode. Alan, can you remind us what the competition details were, please?
Yes, the competition details are as follows. There was a question, and the answer needed to be sent to us to an email address by a certain date, and then we would ship the book to the person who won.
I'm pretty sure he said details.
Sorry. So the details are, the question was, what one thing would you do to make Ubuntu easier? And as a twist, we asked you to do it in 140 characters or less. Tell us what you would do to make Ubuntu easier in 140 characters or less, and send your email to competition@ubuntu-uk.org. And the closing date is the 24th of September, 2012. And we'll announce the winner in the next episode. I'm supposed to be introducing this bit, but there's a cat trying to get my attention, so that cat wins. There's been a bit of a brouhaha on the internet, fancy that, where apparently Linux sucks and has done for years and is
always
rubbish.
Always will do.
Yes, and always will do. And this hasn't come from random unknown people. This actually discussion has been between luminaries such as Mikhail DeCasa, Alan Cox, Linus Torvalds, and many others. And we wanted to have a little chat about that.
Yes, it all started when Miguel wrote, who was one of the founding members of the GNOME project, who wrote a blog post saying that Linux has missed its chance on the desktop and accuses the kernel development team of setting the wrong tone by encouraging people to, throw stuff out if it doesn't work in exactly the right way and not worrying about breaking support
backward
for
Linux. Compatibility stuff.
Yeah, that sort of thing. And Alan Cox sort of, weighed in response, and Liz Torvalds did as well, both kind of defending the way that the kernel works, perhaps unsurprisingly, given that.
So they're defending it from the point of view that Miguel was laying blame for decisions made in desktop products with following the way that the kernel team had done stuff.
Yeah, basically.
But then Linus said, that's not what they do in the kernel anyway.
Yeah.
And he couldn't be held responsible for anything that GNOME did.
So is Miguel doing a bit of revisionism there and rewriting what actually happened in the past, or is it just his perspective?
Well, he seems to be implying that... So we have this thing with the kernel where they don't ensure that binary compatibility for drivers between releases. So if you have a... if they decide to do something in the kernel, it will probably mean that for the next release, you'll break the ABIs, Application Binary Interfaces. Is that the right acronym?
Yep.
Yes. Yep.
Good. Which are the bits which allow the drivers to talk to the kernel. And where was I going with this?
No idea.
But they don't...
Keep going, Mark. You'll get there.
Watching the cat.
They quite deliberately don't worry about preserving
it. Yeah. Whereas external interfaces, the APIs, are the bits which allow the user land to talk to the kernel.
All the software.
Yeah.
And the reason that they don't worry about preserving it is because if there's something that needs enhancing or something not done correctly, they want to just be able to change the kernel, make it as to work as well as it possibly could.
Yes. It's the ultimate luxury in software development.
Absolutely. Yeah, not having to worry about backwards compatibility.
And that's a really good point, because that's very different from how a lot of commercial, big kind of commercial projects work, where you have to worry about backwards compatibility a lot. For example, you can open a Word 97 document in Office 2010, and they don't worry about what?
Alan and the cat.
Oh, right, yeah, Alan's being fussed over by a cat. Yeah, and, you know, you have to worry about backwards compatibility because you have a lot of user buy-in and things like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Do you think it's fair to say that this approach is kind of agile, to use the term totally incorrectly? Yes.
He knows not what he says.
Yeah. Do you think this approach is right, or does it actually hinder the progress of Linux on the desktop?
I think you could originally have maybe argued that people like Microsoft or IBM or whoever have to care about backwards compatibility because people have paid a lot of money for the software and they don't want it to just break next time round.
Uh-huh. And did they sell it on the premise that there would be backwards compatibility?
Well, but there's also, I mean, even now, Windows doesn't change versions very often, but when it does, everybody complains that the software doesn't work on the new version. I mean, and that's like 5 years maybe apart, so people expect it to just work. You could argue that you've not paid for Linux and therefore they get to play around with it, but I think it's gone beyond that point now.
I think it's churlish for us to use the whole, well, you didn't pay for it, you know, if it breaks you get to keep all the parts.
Yes. I mean, I don't agree, but I can see how that could have been how it started, because they didn't have anybody depending on them, nobody had paid them, and whatever.
Well, the point that Linux made was that you can't suggest that just because this is the way the kernel team choose to work, therefore they're to blame for the way the GNOME project choose to work, in that they might do the same things in terms of throwing away big bits, but without maintaining the APIs which allow all of the sort of application software to talk to it.
No, but I mean, you can imagine being in a situation where you're starting off with an open source project and you want to think about how you want to manage your project and how you want to manage development and how you're going to manage, you know, ABIs and versions. And you might look to other projects, other big open source projects. And what other big open source projects at the time were there, other than like Apache and Linux, you know? So you can see why people with other projects might be inspired to do things in that way. They might have made a duff decision, and maybe they should have changed that later on. But I think I don't think it's right to look back and say, well, that was the whole reason why Linux is, you know, screwed on the desktop.
Yeah, I think Miguel makes a point about personality, in that, like, Linus and people have got very strong personalities, and they've sort of influenced, even without meaning to, how people think about things. But then you'd have thought somebody at some point would have just said, okay, well, we can't carry on like this. We need to, you know, from now on, we need to be backwards compatible, which wouldn't be the end of the world. You could do that at any point.
Mm. I don't think everyone follows the argument that Linus is an influential person. You know, you don't all sit around and go, well, yeah, he's done it right for Linux, then we must all follow and not ever question, you know, the decisions he's made. You know, that doesn't follow.
But isn't it the case that one of the things that engages people when they are developing for free software is its responsiveness, its ability to change quickly, and to see the results from the work you're putting into it? You know, it helps people who are giving their time for nothing to engage if they can see things coming out of it and making something shiny and nice that works well. If you're asking people to volunteer to maintain, you know, something that is slow moving and slow developing and, you know, has to go through, I don't know, whatever, some sort of process before you can actually make any changes.
LibreOffice.
Yeah, well, LibreOffice was exactly the example I was going to use, because, you know, it's less exciting to engage, and therefore people don't engage. And LibreOffice has suffered from a lack of engagement, not just because of the code base, but also because of the way the project has been run.
But that works both ways when you compare it to something like Ubuntu, where there's the 6-month release cycle, so there's change all the time. You know, you put a release out, and then instantly you're on the wagon starting developing the next release, and people can see change, you know, very quickly. Laura was talking about, you know, Windows goes from one release to another with a bunch of years between them. With Ubuntu, it's 6 months. But the flip side of that is, yes, it's great, you can see change every 6 months, but the downside is, oh my God, there's change every 6 months, you know.
VMware has to recompile.
Yeah.
every time.
Yes, or you know, patch to support the, whatever the latest version is.
Or the buttons move, or you know,
yes,
the launcher becomes transparent suddenly. And
we don't break everything every release of Ubuntu. We just break a small subsection. So that by the time you reach the next stable release, everything will have been broken.
Yes,
and fixed.
I like to use the word change rather than break.
Yeah, of course. Yes. But it's a good example. There's a lot of change in Ubuntu over the last couple of years. Things like Unity, buttons, introduction of Pulse Audio in the slightly longer term. It's not been easy to get people to accept that change. Mm-hmm. Is that indicative of where Miguel has a point, that people actually would have been quite happy with a GNOME 2 with, you know, a few bits of
people,
polish?
Do you mean developers or users or both?
Or the vocal people.
Well, yeah.
The internet echo
the
chamber.
Internet people.
The internet. But Miguel was talking specifically about technical compatibility, not about people complaining about buttons moving. So sort of leaving aside the user experience stuff, which is the most visible change anyway, whereas the rest of it, to some extent, you can hide it away anyway. I can't remember what I was going to say.
Excellent. Okay.
But I was going to make that point anyway.
Very well made. It was. So is there a parallel between breaking technical compatibility and breaking what users see and making them learn something new? Change. People don't like change. And
I suppose it's whether the developers have to deal with the change or the users have to deal with the change.
Yeah.
And people get used to it. I mean, there was big brouhaha when Unity first came out for loads of different reasons. But one reason was it's changed. It's different. It's very different from what I know before from GNOME 2.
Mm.
And I've seen numerous people over the last 18 months or so like tell me straight up that they don't like it or that it doesn't work the way they want to.
Yeah.
And then 6 months or a year later, they say, well, we've tried it again and actually I've given it more of a chance and actually it is quite nice. Or, yes, I can work with this, or now I get where it's going. So change in that short iteration cycle of every 6 months is good in that we can get the development out there and developers can get access to that stuff like Pulse Audio very early on. And whatever else that we've introduced as previews, like web apps and stuff, people can get access to that before they get to like an LTS version in 18 months time. But people don't like change, but eventually they're kind of have to like suck it up or go and use something else.
Yes. Now it's going to get... Right, okay. Oh, well, the one thing I was going to say before was about the fact that we've got the LTS. So you have that option. I mean, at work, I don't want to be upgrading all the time because I'm worried about the technical compatibility of stuff. So I just leave it on the LTS for more than 2 years.
Well, I was going to say, do you think that having an LTS version that is longer than 3 years on the desktop, because they're doing 5 years now on the desktop, which is more equivalent to the length of a Windows release, 5 years, give or take, will that start to mean that we have a greater legacy of stuff to support, that we can't change applications as quickly because we are supporting these old platforms?
I'm not sure that's the case because, I mean, if you're using an LTS, you're not still getting all of the new versions of all of your applications. You're sticking with what version was released then. While during the interim development cycles, new versions of the applications are coming out, which have to stay up to date with the frameworks they're using, be that GNOME or whatever.
Yeah, because I'm on Firefox 3.8.6, I think it is, at work.
Wow, retro.
Yeah.
I'm on Firefox 38,400.
Yeah, it's really annoying because it's too old for the stuff I'm testing on it.
So, I don't know where I was going either.
So I was going to
was there cake. Something coming in that carrot cake?
I think it's the cake. So I was going to say before that I think it's not a problem to have changes, but it's getting that balance both on the user experience and on the technical developer side. So with user experience, okay, there are going to be certain changes that get people really not that are really noticeable, like the buttons. But if you're constantly throwing those. Every time there's a change, there's something, every time there's a release, there's more and more changes. People just go, oh, I can't take any more, and you might lose them. And the same way with developers, if you're constantly changing things under them, they're just going to give up because it's too much hard work. They don't know where they stand. But if you can do it in a more controlled way and make sure you, for developers, you warn them or you deprecate things but don't remove them for another release, you can build up that trust with them, and then it's not as big a deal, I think.
And back to the original, you know, question, this has all caused the death or the lack of success of the Linux desktop, or it's allowed Apple to surpass us or steal a march on us. Putting aside whether Miguel's actually, you know, the right person to ask about that. well, given he's moved on and he hasn't touched GNOME for a very long time, and, you know, arguably he's someone who was active previously, but now he's completely, you know, he's moved on to other things like mobile technology.
He broke
and stuff.
It all and then wandered off.
And then wandered away. So putting aside whether is he right? You know, has that caused the slow death and decline of Linux, and actually, you know, we're on a hiding to nothing?
I don't think it's helped, but I think the problems go quite a long way further back. One of the things that he points out is that distributions all have different core sets of applications. Yes, the kernel is roughly the same, but people patch that. Red Hat patched that arguably a lot more than Debian, for example. People have different cron versions, different syslog versions, and pretty much every file on different distributions has a different format, a different syntax, and different options. Mm-hmm. And if you're packaging a program for and you're not releasing it just as a source code, you want to release it as a binary, so it's a proprietary application or something you want to compile, you know, you have to make all these different versions for different systems because they all have tweaks. So you're maintaining across a huge ecosystem of things that is ostensibly the same underlying system of Linux.
But do people actually do that? You look at any mainstream proprietary app, they support 2 or 3, maybe 4 at a push, Linux distros.
So as a software manufacturer, you have to support 3 or 4 different environments, plus Windows, arguably maybe 1 or 2 versions, plus a couple of versions of Mac OS. So you're almost doubling your workload in platforms you support for a tiny, tiny fraction of a tiny, tiny fraction of the market.
Right.
Plus you have to, you know, keep upgrading it. Ubuntu has a new release every 6 months, and what happens when the latest release doesn't work with the package that you created for, you know, the one six months ago? So there's a huge amount of overhead which you just don't get with Mac OS and with Windows, I imagine.
Says with his developer hat on.
Yes.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, my shell scripts work across all versions of Linux. So there is this kind of, you know, it is a fragmentation, and I don't see it. There's Linux standards base, but doesn't. You seem to do a huge amount in reducing the underlying complexity of Linux platforms. That's my two penneth. Mark?
Oh, I've been asked a question. Sorry, I didn't
is
have
it
a...
The death
I
now?
What was the question?
It was originally... Is
Linux desktop
dead? Is it dead?
Well, I don't know, really, because I suppose the thing... We were sort of starting to discuss this at work, and one of the things that came up was the fact that what Canonical have done with Unity is markedly different to what's been done before, in that they're saying this is how it's going to work, this is what we're going to use, and sort of actually driving it in a coherent direction, which, I mean, KDE and GNOME have sort of had a vague sort of direction before, but nothing as strict and sort of straightforward and give it to the users, tell them it's what they're going to have.
Opinionated choices.
That's what I'm trying to say.
That's what really impressed me with that keynote that Mark Shuttleworth did, that we, 6 months ago, I guess, was just how clear a vision he set out. I mean, that in itself was just impressive.
Yeah. So, I mean, I agree the Linux desktop hasn't really gotten anywhere, and perhaps some of the reasons we've discussed are the reasons why, but I don't think it's out for the count just yet.
I think one of the things that I know Mark has talked about with regards to the desktop and why we're doing this with Unity, one of the reasons why we're going this path with Unity, is partly because GNOME 2 didn't succeed.
Mm-hmm.
We've had GNOME 2 in Ubuntu for years now, and we haven't made traction. So clearly that has, in inverted commas, failed. That's dead. Let's move on. You know, GNOME have figured that out, and they've moved on to GNOME 3. We all need to kind of move on. Yeah, okay, the nerds and the rest of us that like to tweak and fiddle and run on a, you know, 100 megahertz Pentium, you know, want something lean and small. Fair enough. Carry on with whatever distro and whatever lean desktop you want. But for everyone else who goes into a shop and buys a computer, there's, you know, a choice for them.
Cool. Laura, what do you think?
Yes.
In 30 seconds.
No. Yes, it's dead? No, it's not dead.
I don't know.
You don't know if it's dead.
I don't think it's
is
dead.
Is it sleeping?
I see people, but people can quite happily use it. I don't spend all my time searching for anything anymore. It just works. Mm-hmm. I can use it at work confidently. Well, yeah, pretty much. And that's fine. So I don't think it's dead. I can see it's maybe not growing at the moment.
Mm. Cool. Well, we've had a comment in the IRC channel from Jonah, who says that he thinks in the last 18 months it's been the biggest step for the Linux desktop in the last 10 to 15 years, which is a pretty interesting comment, especially where Ubuntu and Unity is concerned, and the next 18 months will be more so. Mm. So, do you think he's right? Why not send us an email to podcast@ubuntu-uk.org, and we will read out some of your comments in a future episode, won't we?
Yes.
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 And now it's time for some news. I was going to say feedback, but that's later.
Oh dear.
So, GitHub user Herman Heritage has created a repository publishing documentation and code samples reverse engineered from the Raspberry Pi's Broadcom video chip, which currently relies on proprietary firmware. The repository's README states that the hope is that Broadcom will be flattered by the interest in the device and understand the benefits of opening up understanding to a larger audience of potential customers and developers.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, this goes... If you're going to put a device out there and, you know, get developers involved and get them hacking on your thing, you've got to expect someone's going to try and reverse engineer it and get rid of the proprietary blobs that you built in on day one. Really?
Yes.
A vulnerability in the Firefox and Opera web browsers can allow malicious parties to use data URIs to embed phishing pages within a link without the need to have it hosted anywhere.
Yeah, this is very clever, Mark. How does it work?
Right, basically, there's a thing called a data URI, which you can use as, for instance, the source of an image or the href of a link, where instead of having http://, and then the URL, you have data, colon, and then Base64 encoded string of the data.
Right.
So you could take a web page, Base64 encode it, and put it in one of these URLs, and then when you click the link, it basically unpacks that into a page and loads it in the web browser. So it's sort of
it's more difficult to block than a phishing site, because you can't have a central register of them. Your browser can't say, oh, this is a known bad site.
Yeah, exactly. And you could get this data URI, you could put it into a URL shortener, and then you could share the shortened URL.
Right.
And then it would resolve to this data URI, which would then load itself. And then that could be a fake bank login screen or whatever.
Very clever. Watch out for that one in an email box near you.
There is a cat on my lap.
Again.
That's not news.
Sorry, that happens all the time. NVIDIA's Aaron Plattner has revealed that proof of concept work is being carried out on support for the company's Optimus technology on Linux. The power-saving technology allows laptops to conserve power by switching between integrated and discrete graphics processors, depending upon the graphical requirements of the current applications. However, it's so far been absent for Linux users, prompting a recent widely reported outburst from Linus Torvalds regarding NVIDIA's relationship with Linux. So some people are saying the fact that Linus stuck his middle finger up and had a go at NVIDIA has prompted them to actually do something, which, you know, I could see how you could read that into it. But it's good anyway, because there's a lot of laptops, especially the Ultrabook kind of class machine, that have these dual video cards, and they just don't work very well on Linux.
Mm. Cool. Good luck, everybody. Valve Software, creator of the Steam game distribution platform, has made its plans to move into the hardware market clear, posting a job listing for an industrial designer and stating, "We're frustrated by the lack of innovation in the computer hardware space, so we're jumping in." Meanwhile, Steam has released an initial version of its Big Picture 10 interface.
10-foot
interface.
Sorry?
It's a little 10-foot.
There's a little apostrophe there.
I'm
quite a long
TV
way away
interface.
From my screen. Yes,
it's not quite 10 feet away, but yes.
No.
It's the 10-foot UI for basically having a kind of Steam-based console or PC under your telly, so you can play games on the telly rather than sitting at a desk on a computer.
Sounds cool.
Yeah. Mm.
Laura?
Sorry. Stop
Blogger Nuccio has posted a series of reviews of games entered for the Liberated Pixel Cup, a competition to produce a set of freely licensed artwork for games and then produced a freely licensed game using the artwork.
This is brilliant.
Yeah. Makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. You create the artwork up front, put the artwork out there and say, go and create games with this artwork. And loads of people created games of a similar kind of genre, lots of RPG-style games, because right. that's the style of graphics
yeah,
that they
like
created.
An old 16-bit yeah. sort of isometric-y, looky-downy.
But two and a half D, I think they call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, something
they?
Like that. Sort yeah. of like okay. Final Fantasy sort of games.
Yeah.
Okay.
And people create, and they've made all the code available, and so that's lots more games. Excellent.
Excellent.
Always good.
Always good to have games on the Linux.
And, oh, I got this one. Entrepreneur Emery Cosmash, I'm going to say that, has launched an Indiegogo project.
I think you already did say that. Yes.
For the next phone, a smartphone running Ubuntu for Android with distinct visual style that will dock into a collection of peripherals to allow users to carry their working environment with them without the need for syncing between devices. The project has 61 days to reach its $950,000 funding goal. And how's it doing, Alan?
Just checking now, it's hit 1,500 dollars. It changed as I refreshed. So it's got $1,500 out of 950,000.
Nearly a million.
Yeah.
A million.
Wow.
We'll see how that goes.
Yes.
It looks like quite a nice little device.
Well, it's actually a slick video
yeah.
for a device that doesn't exist yet.
Yeah, but I mean, he's got like a little mock-up of it, and it's got a cool like sticky-out screen and shiny. And
it does look quite cool, and you know, with a lot of these Indiegogo and Kickstarter things, you got to wonder whether it will actually happen. And
it's worth $950,000 of anybody's money.
It did, yeah, go for it, Tony.
It does disappoint me a bit that the perks for donating,
yes.
none of the perks are like you get a phone.
Yes.
They're
every other Kickstarter yeah. is like, you know, yeah. one or 10 or 25 bucks and you get a t-shirt or something, and then, you know, a bit more, you get the game, or you get the game in a box, or you get the device. Yeah. And
this is you get thanked and you get a link to buy it when it's out.
Yeah. That does suck a bit. Yeah. And we have a few events. If by few, I mean two. SkyCon on the 6th and 7th of October is in Ireland. And there's lots of interesting, cool people. And they've started...
And Tony.
and they've started taking bookings for tickets
yes.
to go there.
Indeed.
And Randall Monroe is going to be there. XKCD guy. Yes.
Yes. Well, I think some quite interesting speakers.
Mark Shuttleworth.
And me. Yes.
And Mark
Shuttleworth. Yes. So it's worth going along if you're in Ireland or a fancy cheap flight out to Ireland. Come along. Should be a laugh.
Yes.
There's a posh dinner as well on the Saturday night.
Ooh. Oh, you're going to wear your new socks?
Yeah. Just my new socks. Hack Manchester is happening on the 27th and 28th of October at the Museum of Science and Industry as part of the Manchester Science Festival. It's a 24-hour coding competition where you code in a team of four people.
That does sound awesome.
Yes, if you're a developer and don't like sleep.
No, but once you get that, you know, that bug, and you've got a team of people and you're sat around creating something, often, you know, bed is the last thing you want to think of, along with showers and... you know, seeing human contact.
I don't know, 2 o'clock in the morning, it all looks pretty bad.
To the outsider, yes.
Yes, it does sound absolutely awesome.
And that's all the news and events.
I was going to say that.
Well, we had hoped to bring you our usual instalment of Tomorrow's Technology Today, but we seem to be having some... hang on. Sorry, something really odd's going on. There seems to be some sort of signal coming through the time-space continuum. The Lovell telescope's pointed at some wormhole in a far-off galaxy. You know, I think it's some sort of transmission from the future.
Hello, and welcome to Yesterday's Technology Today. I'm Douglas Sigmaron Theta. Greet one to all our listeners, wherever you are around the Galactic Empire. In today's look at Yesterday's Technology Today, which, thanks to the McDonald's Hyperspatial Relativity Induction Loop, we will be recording tomorrow, we'll be telling you about all sorts of technology our barbarian ancestors used to destroy the planet Earth yesterday. Please welcome our ruling Zoid, Deirdre Omega Zircon. Greet one, Deirdre.
Greet one, 23rd Husbandoid. Douglas, isn't it?
It's Douglas.
Don't correct me, Douglas. I'm 15 social grade rankings above you, and we need to get a move on. I have to make the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs. I have a rebel moon to destroy.
Yes. Forgive me, oh great Zoid, but isn't a parsec a unit of distance, not an interval of time?
Should I have the stormtroopers take you down to the Tresh Compactor to be fed to the Dianoga?
Pardon me, Zoid, but not the Dianoga poo-poo. Perhaps we could discuss the progress made for interspecies cleansing in our galaxy. I believe your second deep space battle station is nearing completion.
It better be. I'm not going back to shooting people individually like they did in the old days. Much quicker and tidier to destroy the whole planet in one go.
Yes. What exactly happened to the first battle station? I heard something about a fault with a thermal exhaust port.
I call it my Death Star, as you well know from the set of plans that you lost. Can we get on? Aldershot has to be vaporized to make way for a new hyper-expressway this afternoon.
That's my home planet.
I've just declared it a forbidden planet. Ghastly place. The whole thing is a monument to ancient history. I've lured the rebels there by telling them it's full of Chinese takeaways.
Is it?
No. It's infested with a race of giant hamsters and silly hats and spears who dance ridiculous jigs in defiance of my highly armored robo-chickens. No matter. I shall have to break apart the planet's core with my death ray.
You cannot change the laws of physics, Deirdre. How will you find the energy?
Simply reverse the polarity of the neutron flow.
Yes. What does that actually mean, Deirdre?
It means that my Death Star shall be the ultimate power in the universe.
Well, it seems that's all the Rebel Alliance will have time and relative dimensions in space for. R2-D2 Pip, and may the Zoid be with you.
Joined on the line by Simon Tennant from the Buddy Cloud project. Hello, Simon. How are you?
Hi, I'm well, thanks.
So tell us a bit about Buddy Cloud. Give us the elevator pitch. What is Buddy Cloud?
So Buddy Cloud is an open source social network that's distributed by design. That means everybody can grab our server code, run it, and very much like email service, each server can find the other servers that it needs to communicate with, connect and send messages. And this is really great for people who want to keep control of their data, sort of look after their own privacy, because it means that the data lives on your own server rather than somewhere in Facebook servers or Twitter servers. And it's an open source project, so of course everybody can add to it and bring modules and plug into it and extend it as necessary.
And when did this start, and what prompted you to want to create Buddy Cloud?
Well, I think we've been through about three or four pivots. It started a good 4 years ago when we, even before the iPhone was out, we were looking around and thinking, how could we let users bookmark the places they go to? This is, remember, before even Foursquare was letting you check in at places. And the only phones available at that point were that you could do anything decent on were Nokia phones. So we spent ages working on this Nokia client. We've got a fair number of users using that. But, you know, just location by itself isn't much fun. So we added social features and added more features. And there was always a centralized service, which sort of concerned me a little bit. Then we thought, you know, we've got this great opportunity. We've got all these users here. We've got a great amount of experience about what they want to do and how they behave when you throw a bunch of users together on a product. So let's refactor this and redesign it so that it's completely distributed so that anybody can run it. And that's what we've been doing for the last year. And we're now in the Mozilla Web Forward program, which is an incubator run by Mozilla. And we're about to launch the results of the last year's refactoring and redesign work as a completely distributed social network, which is very, very exciting.
On your website, the big headline says, completely unlike a social network, completely unlike email. But what you've just described sounds a bit like email and a bit like a social network. So how does it differ from what we know as a social network and as email?
Well, so this weekend we were at the TechCrunch Disrupt conference, and a good friend of mine came up to me and he was like, you know, you should really add this stuff and, you know, make it look a little bit more like Facebook and make it have birthday reminders and stuff like that. I'm like, no, Zach, we can't do that. That's terrible. And I think this is a failing of many really good open source projects, is that they try to redesign something as just open source and copy many of the features. And I think really good open source projects will actually think through some of the core assumptions. And that's what we've tried to do with BuddyCloud. We're not going to remind you of when your friends' birthdays are. By all means, if somebody wants to add that to module, great, all power to them. But, you know, at its core, BuddyCloud is just channels that users can post into, either about themselves. Each user has a private channel, and then there's also topic channels, and they can post into those. It's very, very free form. We don't, you know, we have no idea how people will be using this en masse in a distributed way, but I think it's important to not be immediately building fences and immediately sort of putting out forms that users have to fill in to describe themselves in a certain way. So, you know, we'll see what happens. Maybe it does end up looking exactly like Facebook, but rather sort of take that path and find it. It is very much like a normal social network, and that you've just got these channels, but they all interconnect and find each other around the world.
So when you say about, you know, it could end up like Facebook, it could end up looking like, you know, another social network that people are familiar with, does that mean that they must be doing something right if people want it to go in that direction? And given that those other social networks have huge numbers of users, you know, half the planet's on Facebook and the other half are on Google+. Are you in danger of reinventing something that already exists?
You know, we have to be very careful as an open source project that we don't sort of become to kind of a dogma that often is attracted to certain open source projects. You know, there'll be people coming out of the woodwork that have very, very strong feelings on something, and that's great. But usually these people are very, you know, they're the 1%, and I want BuddyCloud to be for the 99%. I want it to be distributed at its core. You know what? My mom doesn't know what a distributed social network is. She just wants to share her recipes or her holiday photos, and it should serve people like her, but also at the core be available to developers to extend. I think when Facebook launched their, like developer program, you could actually build apps on Facebook. Facebook was nothing before these apps came along. Now we can debate whether Farmville is a great addition to Facebook, but that's what we're trying to build. We're trying to build this ecosystem that other people can come along and add to. I think that's really important, but not to focus on, you know, social network built by developers for developers. It's got to be for our moms, for our parents, or you know, just serve normal user needs.
So you mentioned there that, for instance, your mum doesn't really know or doesn't perhaps even care about what a distributed system is, just as long as she can use it and share her stuff. Is that going to be a problem that if normal people want to use it, but they don't know what the distributed thing really means, who's going to be running the distributed nodes?
So if you think about why do you choose to run your own email server and somebody else chooses to run Gmail, it's because at its core, Gmail is still exchanging email with the rest of the world, but they've added some stuff onto the email protocol. And I'd like to think that that's how BuddyCloud turns out, that, you know, we've got this core protocol and that different firms come along and specialize in parts. So, for example, you know, the sad thing is a lot of users don't care about privacy. But it turns out that companies really, really care a lot about privacy on social networks. They don't want their data outside of the firewall. So we've actually had a lot of interest from companies who want to roll out BuddyCloud because it lets them keep their, help them, their internal staff communicate better, but also they keep this data behind their firewall, unlike their existing solutions such as Yammer, where the data sort of lives up in the cloud.
When you talk about having distributed nodes and individuals might, or organizations might customize those nodes, and you know, one might be tailored to look like Facebook, another one might be just for recipe sharing or something, you know, if, is there not the danger that you're going to have the two sides of the coin of having this distributed model? You've got the diversity, but then you've got the fragmentation. And, you know, echoing what Mark asks, how are you going to get people onto BuddyCloud when you've got five users there and five users over there on that node and, you know, three users over there on that? You don't have that that core of people who are driving the thing forward and pulling in their friends into the network and pulling in their family that makes a social network become social.
Okay. Well, there's two questions really there. There's, one is like, how do you stop the sort of fragmentation of the protocol merging off in one direction and then somebody else viewing the protocol and implementing it a slightly different way? So for that end, we solve it using really good unit tests. We have a test suite that will connect to different domains and give developers, and eventually we want this to give users, a quick rundown of you know, what features each domain supports. So when you're deciding to join BuddyCloud, you can go to one page and it'll tell you, you know, firstly, this server is in the UK, so it falls under UK law. It supports media uploading. It supports all of these features. And it supports them 100%, so that gives visibility to that. The second part about how do we sort of keep things together, I think it's important for us to have really good reference implementations that kind of show off what BuddyCloud does, and that's what we're doing here in San Francisco at the moment. We've got a lot of the BuddyCloud team. I mean, obviously, we've spread around the world, but we've got a lot of the BuddyCloud team sitting here in the Mozilla offices. And we're going through and jamming on these reference clients so we can launch them on the 19th. And that's important because it sort of sets the direction for BuddyCloud. And of course, people will implement it differently. For example, one user implemented a terminal BuddyCloud client. You want to look it up, it's called BCCC, BuddyCloud Console Client.
Awesome.
And that's written in Python, and it can run in your shell. And that's great. All power to him. But my mom's not going to be using that.
No. But I can see how that's valuable.
Yeah.
Because you get the kind of the geeks who start these things rolling on board if you've got a way for them that's not Flash and not Silverlight and, you know, and, yeah. They're attracted to those things. How do you... I'm sure you get asked this a lot, and if not, I'm kind of surprised. How do you deal with the question of yet another open-source social network? So status.net was a challenge to Twitter. Diaspora is a challenge to Facebook and Google+. Is your effort not better placed working on StatusNet and... Diaspora, or does BuddyCloud have something that those don't and never will have?
Yeah. You know, there's, I think all of those different projects approach the three problems differently. The way I see the three problems are you've got to solve the federation problem, you've got to put out good reference software, and then you've got to work on the distribution problems. And there's sort of this feeling in the software world, it's like, well, if I build it and it's good enough, it'll just distribute itself. And I don't think that's the case. I think you've actually got to build stuff into the software that will help friends invite their friends or new friends into the system that will sort of send out alerts when certain events happen on the network. as I mentioned earlier, we're working on the reference client. And then at its core, there's this federation layer that's very, very difficult to solve. And we're kind of cheating a little bit because we're just building it on top of the XMPP platform.
Right.
Because that's really, really good at solving federation. You know, it lets servers discover each other, connect to each other with dial-back authentication. So you really know that the server you're connecting to is actually the right server. And it lets, you know, servers resynchronize messages. So that makes our lives much, much easier. We're not reinventing the wheel from day one. And that's sort of why we went down the Buddy Cloud route rather than building on top of something like HTTP, like status.net has done. And I'm actually not too sure how DS4 is doing their federation, to be honest.
While you were talking, I've just registered, so I now have an account. It is. So I was looking at it from the point of view of how it seems so more different from things like Twitter and that. And I think the most obvious thing to me is that on Twitter you post whatever you want and then you define topics by adding hashtags on the end. Whereas this sort of flips it around in that you've got defined channels and you can create new channels and you chat within those, more like the sort of chat room or a pretty, much prettier IRC kind of model.
Oh, right.
Does that sound fair?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you've got circles in Google Plus and you've got mm-hmm. hashtags in Twitter. And so we've got channels that you can spin up for everything. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of one area that you go to talk to about a particular conference and sort of having users pre-classify the information that they're putting into there rather than doing it the other way around.
Running an event and having two different hashtags.
Yeah.
Well, it's worked for IRC for years and years and years,
yeah.
having dedicated channels for topics. It does make sense.
IRC is so inaccessible to people who don't want to put in the geek effort,
yeah.
whereas this is a lot more front-endy.
So what's the... the upcoming announcement you said on the 19th, what happens then?
So Mozilla runs this really great incubator, and if anybody's got an open source project that they're working on, Mozilla, you should definitely like talk to the guys at Mozilla because it's the Web Forward program will sort of it's there to help advance the open web, I think, as they claim. So we've been working on them. Every week we have different sessions with industry experts. So, for example, we had a session with the guy who created Gmail. We had a session with some of Mozilla's UX and UI guys. There's also a lot of business sessions. So, you know, how does Buddy Cloud actually be self-sustaining as a product? Things like that. And then this is the graduation day. So we've got a 7-minute pitch and about 200 investors in the room, and we've got to get all of our ducks in a row.
Wow.
Are
you on target for that?
I think so. I mean, the team is cranking. I should really be out there working with them right now. We've got Felix working on the UI and UX. We've got Vitor, Abmar, and Rodrigo down in Brazil working on different server components. We're just putting some of the finishing touches on the media server, and I think that'll be a really exciting thing because now you'll be able to just drag a small picture or a very, very large MPEG file into a channel, and immediately it's shared with everybody who follows that channel. And I think the implications of that will be rather interesting. And then we've got a couple of guys in Germany, a couple of guys in France, and a whole bunch of other developers pushing in fixes from around the world.
Wow.
So, yeah.
It's a lot of work.
All hands on deck at the moment.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Now, I know you've got another appointment coming up, so we'll let you go. But thanks so much for talking to us, and good luck on the 19th. Hope all goes well, and we'll be keeping a close eye on this.
Indeed.
Thanks very much.
Cool. Thank you.
Bye.
Cheers. Bye. Bye.
And now it's time for the bit about Ubuntu.
Yay!
That's us getting all buzzed up again after the break.
Cup of tea.
What break?
There wasn't a break.
Seamless. There's a new application review process for Ubuntu.
Yep, Johnny Bacon wrote a very long blog post about it.
With photos.
Yes.
Of
yes.
his feet,
which seems rather unnecessary.
Yes. It's trying to address some of the issues that about getting software from Ubuntu developers into Ubuntu and from non-Ubuntu developers, and trying to get over some of the manual steps, automate as much of it as possible, and set down some guidelines that are kind of future-proof for more developers coming down the pipe when we get our 200 million users next year.
Developers in pipes.
Best place for them. We reached beta 1 of Quantl Quetzal, which will be Ubuntu 12.10.
Quetzal.
Quantl Quetzal.
And it's not going to fit on a CD anymore.
No.
Yes. I mean, no.
So it'll be on a...
We discussed this at the last UDS. Whether it should go oversized, so we don't have to worry about fitting on an ISO image that would go on a CD.
It's looking like it'll be 800 meg the image.
So this is so that it fits in stuff into the installer like LVM and stuff, so that you don't have to have a separate alternate CD.
Not necessarily for that. It's just so that we've got more room and we don't have to keep obsessing about getting below, you know, 702 megabytes or whatever the magic number is.
You know, I said before about backwards compatibility being the ultimate software developer luxury. Image size, that's the other one.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's worked well for a long time in keeping us restrained, but the problem is we obsess about it. You know, we can't put that on the CD because, you know, there's not enough room. And, you know, so this gives us a bit of breathing room, but they're not going to let it go, you know, stupid. It's not going to be like a 4 gig image. It's only going to go over by a bit. There's only going to be a bit of breathing room, but it's enough that it's...
Slippery slope.
Well, no.
It is.
And Mark said at the last UDS when this was discussed, he said, I'll stand up and be the one that says, no, it doesn't go over that. You know, it's...
So how are you supposed to install it? You burn it to a DVD?
Or USB.
Most modern computers boot off USB these days.
If you've only got a CD drive, you get the server install and do apt-get install X.
Ubuntu desktop.
Or the mini ISO.
Oh, there's a mini ISO.
Yeah, there's a mini ISO, which is tiny, and you could put it on one of those business card size
CDs.
Those ones
CDs
that everybody had in, like, 2002.
I found a box full of them the other day.
And you.
Yeah. Yeah, so you can still do a minimal kind of... you don't have to use a USB stick or a DVD.
Is it easy to put an image on a USB stick? Because I remember having to follow instructions.
No, there's two apps for it, in fact, now. There's one called UNetBootIn, and there's another one called USB Disk Installer or something.
There's USB Startup Disk Creator, which is in Ubuntu. Yeah. But if you want to bootstrap yourself, you're already on another OS, then... UNetBootIn is the good one because that works and it looks and feels the same on Ubuntu, Linux, Windows, and OS X. It's the same app.
And it'll even get the ISO image for you.
Yeah, that's really cool. You just download UNetBootIn and it says, okay, what do you want to put on the USB key? And you choose, you know, Fedora or something. Do you want 32-bit or 64? Hit go, and it goes and gets the ISO and does it all for you. It's really quite good. It's really basic, but it's
better than DDing on the shell into a raw device.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what I remembered.
No, you don't need to do that anymore.
Cool.
The good news is if one of those two applications doesn't work, the other one sometimes might.
Or you can DD.
Yeah.
So Ubuntu CE 12.04 has finally... with emphasis,
CE,
being released.
CE.
Is this like the...
It's a kite mark edition.
This is Christian edition, isn't it?
Ah, right, okay.
Oh. I see. I have no idea what the CE bit means.
So it's absolutely chock full of Bibles and...
yeah, it's got special religious wallpaper and that sort of thing.
Yep. And... yeah, it looks quite nice.
It comes with Dan's Guardian by default for blocking all kinds of filth.
I can't decide though whether you disapprove of the filth or of Dan's Guardian.
Or the blocking of the filth.
That's what I mean.
No comment.
Ted Gould has posted about setting up throwaway desktop sessions in the cloud.
Yes.
So yes. Isn't that what cloud is anyway?
Well, no, but for the cloud, usually we talk about running server things in the cloud.
I see.
But this is so that you can spin up a copy of Ubuntu on a remote cloud somewhere so that you can maybe test it. I mean, he's got a bunch of scenarios in his blog post.
Maybe you're
trying to get around Dan's Guardian to look at some code. And you don't want any, to leave any traces.
Yeah.
We should, and also do things like if you want to test the desktop, and or if you've, if you want to see what an app looks like on a clean system. So if your system's like got all kinds of stuff on it, your development tools, and you want to see if your app works on a clean system, you could just spin one up in the cloud, install your app, and you know test it remotely, and you don't have to have a separate PC or a virtual machine on your local desktop that takes a while to spin up and takes disk space and so on. There's lots of like scenarios where actually it makes sense to be able to just randomly spin up remote testing different versions, you know, that kind of stuff.
It's kind of like you don't need to carry your Ubuntu installation around on your Android phone anymore.
Yeah, if you've got a sufficiently decent connection. I mean, I think that's actually where it came from.
Okay.
The development of this came from that part of the project.
The idea that you want to have it everywhere.
Yeah, just have a thin login, a thin device that could connect to a fat desktop running somewhere else, whether it's in the cloud and it's spun up on demand, or whether it's in your corporate data center and it's always there and you connect to it and it's still running all the stuff that you were running yesterday, that kind of thing.
Shiny. Cool. Okay, there was a couple of things in the not about Ubuntu this time around as well.
Yeah.
The first one is that there's a big write-up on OCCAMP in the new edition of Linux Format. That's number 163.
So if you couldn't make it, buy Linux Format and find out what you missed.
Yeah, subscribers will have that dropping through their post yesterday.
Yes.
Or today.
Yes, I think the subscriber copies are out now. It'll be in the shops in the next day or two. And apparently it's very good and a big three-page write-up. So
excellent.
With pictures of the crew and such.
Yes, so you don't have to look at those.
And finally, in the not about Ubuntu, oh, I've given myself the name again.
Clem,
yes. From the Linux Mint distro, has described Nautilus 3.6 as a catastrophe and explained Mint's decision to create a fork of the file manager to reintroduce all of the features that were removed from version 3.4. And he also described Ubuntu's decision to stick with 3.4 for 12.10 as the right decision.
I agree.
Mm. Yeah, change is bad, isn't it?
So a little while ago, we put 3.6 in the repository. And when I got 3.6, I noticed like a significant number of things that just irritated me about the new Nautilus.
Right.
Like keyboard navigation had completely changed. Mm. You can't press backspace to go up a directory level anymore. You have to press Alt up.
Mm.
You know, keyboard shortcuts shouldn't change.
No.
And the menu that you normally get along the top of the screen moved to a cog over on the right-hand side.
I hate when things move around the screen.
When they move from the left one to the right, to the other, it's just ridiculous.
I tell you what, this right is left. Why it's almost, Linux has failed on the desktop.
Yeah,
right to left, like, I can cope with.
Yes, exactly. It's almost like the GNOME project tried to integrate it with their own desktop, their own file manager. I mean, it's just outrageous.
It really is.
I'm glad we got rid of it.
Yeah. And that study in whining hypocrisy brings the not about Ubuntu to an end.
And it's time for your feedback.
It is indeed.
E8HFFF. I assume that's a...
Is that a typo?
No, that's not the cat walking on the keyboard.
I think that's somebody who's logged into the website and just given us a short name. Commented on the post for episode 13. That
old-time radio segment got a bit rude. But funny.
Mm. What was that?
This was the one from episode 13, as
about
it says.
Personal
this
massage
was the
devices.
Tomorrow's technology today.
Go into the rudeness in complete detail.
I didn't listen to it, but somebody
told
me about
to
it.
Episode 13 sure. And hear all about it.
Yes. And we had a couple of other people saying similar comments about that. So, yes, it was quite rude. Hopefully they won't get any ruder than that.
Yeah, I haven't heard it. It's probably for the best.
Well, it's a problem because tomorrow's technology today was recorded yesterday, so how can we possibly... Nigel Verity emailed in to point out...
Right at the top of the screen, when you give the countdown to the next show, you use blue text on an orange background on your website. This is one of the combinations which causes problems for people with even mild colour blindness. If you were to change it to white on orange... As on the download buttons, it would alleviate the problem for quite a few people. Just a minor niggle, though. Otherwise, it's an excellent website.
Yeah, Mark.
Yeah. Well,
go fix it, Mark.
Good point.
Yeah, that sounds like something we should be able to do, I think.
Yeah, that's no problem.
It's something Mark should be able to do.
I'll endeavour to get it fixed before the next show. How about that? So thank you, Nigel.
If you email again Nigel and let us know if he hasn't done it, then we can keep on the case.
Stuart Lawson tweeted UUPC to say,
still a cool cast. Your comment on 386 servers saved me. Wonder why it had collapsed. Dinosaur with plus 10,000 JPEG on 386 server.
Took me a little while to interpret that. What he's saying is, we are still a cool podcast.
Oh, yay! Yeah.
Hurrah! Okay.
And our comment about i386 servers was useful to him because he had broken his i386 server by upgrading, presumably, to a later release of Ubuntu. He has 10,000 JPEG images on an i386 server. Which
is it an old computer?
Or he's got lots of pictures of dinosaurs.
Yeah, exactly, yes.
10,000 dinosaur pictures.
Well, either the server is or he is. So, it's old. Right. So, yes, that was a very useful comment. Hmm.
Tony is our universal translator.
Isn't he?
He knows how the youth talk and ting.
He's like our babel fish.
Yeah, so it's crawling in your ear.
And thanks!
Andy Stanford Clark tweeted to tell us about
cool hash Raspberry Pi intros for hash Cambridge freshers from at Izzy L0, Isabel Long et al. And then a URL. So basically, Isabel Long, friend of ours.
From Surrey Look?
Yes, spent some time at Cambridge University and wrote some awesome Raspberry Pi introduction. So it's a great way if you've bought your Raspberry Pi and it's currently sitting in a drawer and you're wondering what to do with it, you can go through these tutorials and we'll put a link in the show notes and that will take you from zero to hero in no time at all.
And you may have seen Izzy previously as she's a mate of Rory Coughlin-Jones and helped him set stuff up. She's been featured on the BBC a couple of times.
She is a youth.
Yes, you don't have to be a Cambridge fresher to enjoy these tutorials. They are available for everybody, I believe.
Yes.
Excellent. And that's the end of your feedback.
Sorry. Sorry, I just deleted the outro. Oh, here we go again.
Right, okay. That's all for this episode. Thank you for listening. You can find out how to get
in touch with us on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, including voicemail numbers and Twitter feeds, Facebook and IRC channels. Let us know what you think of the show or give us your thoughts about Ubuntu and the community around it. Join us on Tuesday the 25th of September for our next live broadcast.
Yay! Mark's got a funny colour.
He has, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you for that.
That's honestly, all right. I'm ready for it now.
Laura's wide awake. Let's do another episode now.
Yes.
Bonus content.
Such as?
Cat cast.
Yes. Let's talk about cats.
Right. I think it's time for us to go. Mark did an impression of a cat.
Oh!
No, go on.
No, we're back.
No, it's gone.